So welcome to the last lecture of this first part of the course. And in spite of doing this year more lectures than usual, I wasn't able to cover all the topics that I intended according to the syllabus. And this will be partially remedied in part two. Because I wanted to talk to you about black holes and scrambling and things like that, but we don't have time. However, some of the things that I'm going to say today are necessary tools for that. So they're very useful for that. So let's say where we are, okay? So let's try to remember where we are. Okay. So we proved a statement a couple of lectures ago that said, okay, so if I take the distance between the state that is evolving, and this is the state restricted to a subsystem S, and its time average, that I will call omega s. So remember that omega is just phi bar, which is in turn the defaced state in that basis, and omega s is the trace over the b part of omega, where your Hilbert space is hs tensor hb. And similarly, okay, phi t is your time evolution, and phi ts is the trace over b of phi t. Okay. So, and this is the distance at the time t between these two states. And then I take the time average, remember what the time, how we defined it, we show that this is upper bound. Actually, I just claimed, and the details are in the notes, but the proof is essentially the same of what I showed you about the expectation values of observables, because this is the trace distance, so it has to do with the expectation values of projective measurements. So it's smaller than 1/2 the square root of d square s trace of omega square. Trace of omega square is the purity of omega, that is the purity of the completely defaced state. And so you see, it does depend on the initial state. So now we would like to argue what happens.
Can you write a bit larger?
Huh?
Can you write a bit larger? I cannot see what.
Larger? Larger here?
Yeah, yes, yes. Okay, thank you.
It's okay? Mm-hmm. So you see, this quantity depends on the initial state. And we would like to know how this thing is on average. Okay? On average, averaging over all the initial states, it is what we called the expectation value in the Hilbert space of some quantity. So we would like to compute this expectation value and then see how we can use it in here. So is it clear what is that we're trying to compute? What type of expectation value this is? Okay. And we showed that this object can be written as the trace on a larger space, of this operator T2 that we have defined. T2 is an Hermitian operator in H tensor 2 and is defined as in a basis of H tensor 2 in this way. Okay. Okay, so we have this trick that is very, very useful. Okay. And now, if we remember what is omega, which is this, this means the expectation value of the trace of T2. And now this is dH tensor 2 on phi tensor 2. And because everything is linear, this is the trace on of T2 on dH tensor 2 on the expectation value of phi tensor 2. And this is exactly the reason why we used this trick, because we wanted to make everything linear so that we can do this. And yesterday we learned some stuff about the R measure, that is the measure that allows us to take these expectation values. And we learned this result, that the expectation value of phi tensor 2 in the Hilbert space is equal to the identity in my total space plus T2 over d times d plus 1. Remember, this is what we arrived at. So now what we need to do is to take this result and to plug it in here. Okay, so let me do that. Okay, so we have the trace of T2. Now let me first plug this thing in here. H tensor 2 plus T2. Okay. This is a number. I can pull it out of everything. Okay. Okay. And now I left some space here because I need to write this object, dH tensor 2. So you remember that dH acting on something means the sum remember this is our definition of how you deface an operator. Okay, so the tensor 2 of this is just this tensor 2. So let me write it. You will have let me see what notation I used here. I didn't even use a notation. What I wrote was okay. Let me write it like this. You agree? Okay, so now this is the object that we need to compute. Okay, so let's see. So what happens when I contract this with identity? The identity does nothing, right, to this object here. So we just have, and then we have this T2, Okay, so let's write it explicitly so we see what this is. So this is the sum on KK prime of KK prime, the identity, so KK prime, then we have the identity that did nothing, and now we have KK prime and KK prime. Oh. Okay. Well, obviously, this does nothing, right? This is one. Right? This is just one. Okay. But now we are acting with the T2 here, which is linear. So what it does is to swap K and K prime. So this is K prime K, K K prime. And then I take the delta. Sorry. Then I take the trace, which will give me a delta KK prime. You see that? So I have to take the, here I'm taking the trace of this. I'm computing the first term. See, if I take the trace, this is the sum over KK prime of K prime, K prime K. As you can see, this is the delta KK prime. So this kills one of the sums. You're left with one sum. So this is D, this number. So you see how powerful is this method. We are actually taking a very complicated integral in the Hilbert space. And then, you know, because we have developed this algebraic way of doing that, you know, it's just a number. It's the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay, now let's do this. Okay. Well, and, okay, yeah, we have to do that. Okay, so we know that T2 on this does. This was KK prime. This becomes K prime K. And then I'm contracting it with this. So already here, I get a delta. Okay? And then when I contract it again, I have the same delta, actually. It's not a different delta. So this calculation gives us the D again. So the second term also gives us D. Is it clear, or you want me to go step by step? Or you want to try to do it on your own? It's a very similar calculation. Answer, please. Okay. Great. So the result is 2D over D plus 1. Sorry. 2D over D times D plus 1, which is 2 over D plus 1. Okay. So this is what we are computing. Let me write here the result. This is 2 over D plus 1. Good. Okay. So now let's apply this result in the thing we had above. Okay? Yes.
Didn't we expect that this should be an operator?
Trace of omega square, what is it? It's a number. But what is phi tensor 2?
That's not
okay. The expectation value of this operator did I write a number or an operator?
That would be an operator.
And that's it, that is an operator. But then, when I trace this with the swap operator at omega tensor 2, I get a number as I should. Other questions? Okay. So now let's try to apply this finding to the result that we have in the first box. Okay, so we need a couple of passages. So first of all, consider the expectation value of this object. So we have computed it yesterday, remember? On a generic space H. It was the identity on that space. So let's remember this. But in general, because this theory is very useful.
So why is divided by DI is not D?
Because this is a random state on S. So it's the identity on S over the dimension of S.
But it's also an operator on the whole Hilbert space. So what's the average take on?
No. I'm talking just about OS. This is an operator just on S. It's the trace over B of omega. Trace over B, there is no B anymore. I traced it out.
So if it is an operator on HI, so how can you take the average? Because average, the linear operator is defined on the whole Hilbert space.
Yeah, so okay, so this can be done in many ways.
Yes.
So what you can do is to first do this, because everything is linear, and then trace out to B, and then it's obvious it's equal to this.
Yes.
Okay? Okay, good. Now, this is so remark. This is this thing, right? I am doing the expectation value on the full H. Now imagine that this is H, and I have some subspace. Let me call it calligraphic R. Okay. So this means that this R can be written as some projection, let me call it R, over H. Do you agree? Very good. So this allows me to define an expectation value on R as the expectation value on PRH. But now this thing is clear what it is, because I can just take the average over all H, and I take a random state in H and I project it on R. Then I take another random state on H, I project on R. Again, everything is linear, so that's why I can do that. So I can generalize these results to averages in R. So in this case, here, I would have something like PR instead of having the projector on the full, this would be the trace over B of PR. This is what it would be. Right? This is coming from the fact that we are tracing over B the identity, which is the projector on the full Hilbert space. Now I would have something like this. Okay. So this is a useful generalization because I will comment this at the end, but one may want, for instance, to take averages. Imagine I introduce a Hamiltonian, and instead of averaging over all the states, I want to average over all the states in some energy window. Okay, so I need restrictions. So generally speaking, so in this case, this is this object, but generally speaking, this is some reference, some state, let me call it large capital omega S. It's some reference state, okay? It's the equilibrium state given the restrictions. Remember that omega is an equilibrium state. Remember, it's steady. It's not a state that you can reach by unitary evolution, but we are saying that the distance between our state and the equilibrium state on average, on time average, is very small. Is upper bounded by trace omega square. So we want to understand how large on average is trace omega square. We understood. Now we want to put things together. Okay. So knowing this, I can always, so let me consider this distance. Can you read this or is it too faint? Too faint, okay. Okay, now remember this is a distance, right? So it must obey a triangular inequality. So I can write this as, oh, I have a typo. Oh. No, let me use this one. Okay, no typo. So let me consider this distance. I want to know now how the distance between my state and the equilibrium state average over all the possible conditions. Okay, so this must be smaller than or equal than you agree? Because this is a distance. And this is always true for every t. Do you agree with this statement? This is just the triangular inequality. The distance between A and C is smaller than MB plus BC. Okay. Now, so since it's always true, it's also true in this way. Okay. And now what I want to do is take the expectation value of this. Okay, see, this is a linear operation, so the expectation value of a sum is equal to the sum of the expectation values, right? So it's smaller than the expectation value of this. Plus the expectation value of this. Oh, by the way, you realize that here I don't need to do the time average because this is time independent. So I may as well erase this, right? And I have the expectation value of this thing. Okay. Good. Now we know that this object is upper bounded by that expression, right? So this is smaller than E of, so 1/2 square root ds square, which I could just take out, I have a ds here, trace of, square root of trace omega square. Okay, and now I have this thing here, this expectation value. Okay, so this is something that we have not calculated. So let me give you the result, then we will argue about this result, okay? And you find the details in the notes. So this one is upper bounded by the square root, by 1/2 the square root of ds over db. Okay. We will go through the steps of these calculations later. For now, let's take the result. So let me put it here. Okay. If I made some, I have a typo. Okay, all right. So you see, we know the expectation value of this. Not the, but the, now we have a problem. This is not a linear function. So I cannot pass e through the square root. However, this is a concave function, right? So this means that the expectation value of the function is smaller than the function of the expectation value. So I can upper bound again. And now I have the expectation value of this. And the expectation value of this is 2 over d plus 1. Let me put this ds back here. Okay, plus 1/2 ds over db. Okay, we are done, because now d is the dimension of all Hilbert spaces, so it's ds times db. So you see that both terms have a square root of ds over db. I mean, in the limit that this is much larger than 1, this one can be ignored. So this is actually equal to 1 plus square root of 2 over 2 of square root of ds over db. Okay. Okay, good. So this is the result that we wanted. Because we are saying that if I average this condition over all the possible initial states in the Hilbert space, then this distance, the distance to the equilibrium state, is on average smaller than this number. Now remember that ds is small, is order 1, right? It's our local space. or in any case, we want dB to be much greater than dS, we can consider dS that is large. So let me use this more interesting condition. But as long as dB is much greater than dS, this is an exponentially small number. Okay. So on average, this distance is very small. Now, next thing we need to do is to argue about fluctuations, right? Because something is what we did so far, right? You have some average value, and you know you could fluctuate around this average value. However, notice that the distance is a non-negative number, right? So, and I'm saying that the average is very small. So if the average is this number that is very small, the fluctuations cannot be large. The fluctuations are of the same order of the average. This is called the Markov inequality. The probability that there are effects, Markov inequality, it's a companion to the Chebyshev inequality. It says if you have a random variable that is non-negative, then the probability that x is greater than that x minus x average is greater than a, so this is a measure of the fluctuations, is smaller than the expectation value of x over a. So because this is exponentially small, this means that this probability is very small. So okay, there are no fluctuations. It's a beautiful result. So we have finally proven something, that it is true that whether you equilibrate in probability or not depends on the initial condition. However, for the overwhelming majority of the initial conditions, it is true that you equilibrate. So the conditions such that you do not equilibrate, like one of the examples that I gave you, is very rare. If you take a random initial condition, then you will equilibrate in probability. Yes?
Can you give a physical reason why we use the capital omega s, not small omega s? Because small omega s, the descent also is bounded than just the first term. Why we bother us to use the capital omega s?
Because I I could have done it in another way. I think it would be an equivalent proof. Yeah. So you're saying, but this means that I should have obtained from the beginning a result on the temporal average of the distance between this and capital omega. But I think it's equivalent.
Okay.
So let me repeat again what is this result. And then I'll show you one more thing. Also, because I need to argue about this thing that I didn't show yet. Okay? So let me just repeat what I said. So let's try to read this result. If I take my state, and I look at the tests, it's where I do the measurements. And I say, how different this state is from the equilibrium state? The probability that by observing it at the time t, and by picking a random initial condition, the probability that this distance is greater than this very small number is very small. So, in other words, almost always, and for almost all the initial conditions, your state at the time t that is evolving unitarily, locally, looks like the equilibrium state. So you see, we have proven something that seemed impossible. In spite of having unitary evolution in a closed quantum system, we know that there is equilibration. The measurements that we do after, if I look them over a large time, eventually we'll have a typical value. Yeah, unless I pick very weird initial conditions. Yeah.
Do you do the same thing for thermalization? Like,
wonderful. Yes. However, it gets a bit more complicated. But the key ingredient is that now, if you want to argue, okay, so this is just equilibration. And I'm saying my initial state looks like capital omega S, this is what I said, which is the identity. Now, the identity, the completely mixed state, is a thermal state. It's the thermal state at infinite temperature, right? So, do you agree? Do you agree that this is the case? Yeah. Okay. So how do we, so where is thermalization here? So this is a thermal state. So in order to talk about thermalization, as you can see, we must have a notion of energy, because this also gives us a notion of temperature. So what is actually temperature? Temperature is defined in this way. So if you have some initial state, and you compute the energy of this initial state, this means this, right? And I want to say, oh, this state has a thermal expectation value. So, because it is almost like a thermal state, looks like a thermal state when I make a measurement. So this is, means that I'm saying this. So you see, this equation equal to this defines beta. This is the definition of temperature. So now what you can do is imagine that I pick my initial states with a well-defined value, or, you know, in a very small energy window, so a very well-defined value of the energy. This means I'm fixing this number. But if I'm fixing this number, means that I know what is beta. Okay. So now what I have to do is to do my expectation values not on the full Hilbert space, but on this restricted Hilbert space that is the one corresponding to this energy. Okay. All the states in the Hilbert space that for that Hamiltonian have the energy between E and E plus small delta. So my contention is that when you do this for your initial condition, so to understand what is the capital omega, this becomes this. And why it becomes this? So first of all, I showed you why it can be like this, you know, because I am introduced this object by fixing the energy. Why? That's why it is possible that it is like this. But of course, I have to show it, right? That it's exactly like that. And in order, so that's a very complicated proof, and there are additional assumptions. But the key element is something that I want to prove rigorously, okay? Which has also importance for another type of considerations, like you know, things in black hole scrambling. So I really want to tell you that. Yes, what's the question?
A small question. Because we know from the mechanics that if you fix energy, the temperature is not fixed. And in the micro example and Kanako example.
Yeah, I'll get that. Okay, I'll get that. Okay, so let me get that. So in statistical mechanics, you know this, that if you fix the energy and you ask what is the state that has maximum entropy with that energy, then that is the Gibbs state. And that defines the temperature.
Gibbs state is at fixed temperature, right?
Yeah, no.
Gibbs state is expansion of all the states.
If you fix the energy and you say, my state must have this energy and must have a maximum entropy compatible with this, then the solution is this, which fixes also the temperature. Okay? So this is the standard argument of statistical mechanics. So now you see that if I fix the energy, our argument has boiled down to the fact that when I take my averages, my state has maximum entropy. Okay? Okay. So, and this is what I'm going to prove. And this thing, so it's important for this, for that piece of proof that is missing, and for general considerations. So I have the next 17 minutes. Let me try to argue this. What is the average entropy in H? And this question as first of all a trivial answer. Because if I take a pure state, remember that we are always averaging over pure states. So if I take a pure state in H, the entropy of this pure state is zero for all phi, right? So the average is zero. There is not much meaning talking about the entropy just like that in the Hilbert space. However, we are saying that all our discourse is based on what happens to observables. So is the entropy seen by an observable? Why the observable sees an entropy different from that of the state? Because the observable only sees the local state. Right? Remember that the expectation value of a local observable in your state is equal to the expectation value on just the system S of OS psi S, the local state.
The psi S is a big state or pure state?
This one is pure.
Oh, okay.
So, as a pure state, psi has zero entropy. However, what I see depends not on psi, but on psi s. So now I can ask the question on psi s. What is the entropy of psi s for a generic psi? So you see what I'm saying? I have my h that is this. I pick a state in here, and I look on it partially because that's where I do my measurements. And I ask, what is the entropy in this partial state? So question, if the parent state psi is pure, is psi s pure? You say no. Can you elaborate?
I'm not sure how to prove it, but I think we did it in our quantum theory course. So we showed that it has to be a mixed state.
It doesn't have to, but it could be. So example, imagine that my state is this state, some state chi s tensor, some state psi on B. Okay. So what is psi s? Is the trace over B of chi s tensor psi B. So it means that I am only doing the trace on here, right? So this is equal to chi s. Times this expectation value, psi B. Oh, but this is a state on B, so its norm is 1. Oh, so the density matrix of psi S is just a projector, means it's pure. Okay, so it could be pure. When is that this thing fails? Yes, when it is entangled. In fact, this is the definition of entangled. If the partial state is mixed, oh, then the state is entangled. This is the meaning of it, right? So I would like to know the expectation value of this object. So I vary psi in my Hilbert space, and I look at the entanglement on psi s. Okay. And I want to do on average how entangled it is. So you see, now before we argued about what is the average defaced state, and now I'm arguing about what is the average entanglement in the Hilbert space. Okay, let's compute that. We don't need this. Okay, so first of all, remember what is entanglement. Entanglement is of a state psi. You also know, and we are particularly interested to the von Neumann entropy, right? S1. Okay. Now, imagine that I compute S2. Which is larger, S1 or S2?
S1.
Okay. So, by the way, this is also in the notes if you want to see the proof, but they're like this, okay? And maybe when you look at the proof, you can see what is the reason behind that. But remember that it has to do with the sum of the powers of the eigenvalues. And these are all eigenvalues that are at most one. Okay, so imagine that you have many numbers. Yeah, the eigenvalues are a distribution probability, right? You have all these numbers to the power alpha. At most, one of them is one. Otherwise, they are all smaller than one. Okay. So let me order them from the largest one to the smallest one. Okay. When alpha is very large, the smallest one decreases very fast. Okay. And in the limit of alpha becoming larger and larger, the only one that counts is the first one. So if the only one that counts is the first one, this entropy looks a lot or a little. Because the entropy is the sum of these values. It's less, right? Because I have only one element. And if alpha is not very, very large, but it weighs basically how many eigenvalues I'm considering. So the smaller is alpha, the more values I'm considering. And when alpha is equal to 1, they're all on the same footing. And that's why S1 is the largest of all. Okay, then you see the formal proof is in the notes. Okay. So I will make a computation on S2, which will give me a lower bound to the entanglement entropy. So entanglement entropy will be actually greater than the one that I compute, okay? Okay. So S2, why I want to do S2? Because S2 is minus the log of the trace of psi square. And remember that we are looking at psi on the system S. So I should put S here. We have already said that if psi is not in the subsystem, it's pure, the entropy is zero. So we are looking at this one. So the expectation value of S1 will be greater than or equal than the expectation value of S2. Do you agree? In virtue of this, which is the expectation value of this number. And this is greater or equal because of the concavity of minus log, again, the Jensen inequality, of the expectation value of the purity of the reduced state. Oh, but this is a calculation similar to the one that we have done. It's not the exact same calculation, because before we were calculating the purity of dH psi. Now we are calculating the purity of trace B of psi. So these are two different operations, but they're both linear. Okay, so all I need to do is to spell out what is this operation and then use the previous results. Okay, so we have minus log the expectation value. Okay, here we have our usual problem, right? That this is not linear, but we know how to cure it. We have psi s tensor 2, and then we have the permutation operator on the Hilbert space. And now I have to be careful because if I just write a T2, it's not clear what I'm swapping, but this must be an operator on two copies of S, right? So let me put a subscript S there. 5 minutes, great, yeah, I can make it. Okay. Do you agree with me? Okay. And now remember the very basic fact, this fact that I'm using all the time, right? That the trace of an operator on S in psi S is that. Okay, so let me just plug it in. Now it will be the trace on the full space of my operator decorated with the identity on B times the total state. Well, now you see why this is beautiful. Because not only everything is linear, but and therefore when I take this expectation value, gets here, and I know this result. Right? So let me write. This is minus the log of the trace of TS2 tensor 1B. Of course, the trace means this. And now here I have the expectation value of psi tensor 2. And we have this result. Where is it? It's there. See? Let's just plug it in. I forgot the minus here. Okay, so this is equal to minus the log. So if I put it here, you know what I mean. I'm saying that this one is greater than what I'm going to write here. Minus the log of the trace, then I have TS2 tensor 1B times this expectation value, which is 1 H tensor 2 plus T2 D over D plus 1 is our basic result on the hard mesh. Question to you. Where does this identity live? Where does this T live? And what dimension is this? This is the identity on two copies of H. This is the permutations on two copies of H. And this is the dimension of H, not of two copies of H. Right? But this is the identity just on B, and this is the swap, is the permutation operator just on S. Okay. So let's do this computation. Sorry. Okay, minus log, trace of, okay, so let me pull this out. This times identity is itself, right? It is TS2 tensor the identity on B. Oh, here I made an abuse of notation. This is the identity on two copies of B. Do you agree? Just like this is the identity on two copies of S and B. Okay. Plus, now I have this time T2. But notice that the T2 is equal to T2S tensor T2B. Do you agree? Remember how our swap operator is done. I can swap things with any order I want. So it's a tensor product of all local swaps. So this means that when I have the product of this times this is TS times TS. What is TS times TS? Is the identity on what?
S.
On two copies of S. Tensor T, two on what?
B.
B. Good. Not two copies on B, because it's the swap between the two copies. OK. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's the swap between two copies of B. You're swapping, so you need two copies. OK. Oh, you see, now I need to take these traces, but we have done this exercise. What is the trace? The trace of a tensor product is the product of the traces. What is the trace of TS?
DS,
good. So this is minus log, and then we have 1 over d, d plus 1. And now we have ds, right? Times, what is the trace of 1 tensor 2 on b?
db
square, good, db square. Now, what do you think? What is the trace of this object? So it's the product of these two traces, right? What is the trace of this?
Ds.
It is. You see, there is a tensor 2. So it's the it's the trace of 1s times the trace of 1s.
Ds square.
Ds square.
Db.
OK. Good. Ds squared db. OK, we're done. Because now remember that d is ds db. So what we get is minus log of here, I can collect ds db, which will simplify with this. And so here I'm left with ds plus db over d plus 1, which is ds db plus 1. Okay. So this is an exact result. The average entanglement entropy is greater than minus the log of this number. It only depends on the dimensions of s and b. And now let's see what this number looks like in the case that db is much larger than ds, and ds also being greater than 1. OK? Well, if this is true, here I can neglect ds. And obviously, here I can neglect 1. So I will have db over ds db, which is 1 over ds. So in this case, we have that the average entanglement entropy is greater or equal than 1 over ds. Sorry, minus log 1 over ds, which is ds. Sorry, log ds, sorry, of course. Which is the maximum one. So on average, we get to the, if you wish, to the lower bound of the purity, and therefore to the upper bound of the entropy, because one are the opposite of the others. And again, in virtue of the Markov inequality, and there are even tighter bounds. This means that the probability of having something different from this is extremely small when the S is large. So the result is that the overwhelming majority of states in the Hilbert space are maximally entangled, provided that I look at them locally enough. So if you ask a question, okay, I pick a state in the Hilbert space. So actually, you were right. You were right when you said, well, if I look at it locally, it's going to be mixed, because it's almost always like that. Of course, but I just wanted to show you that there are some specific conditions when it's a product state, such that this doesn't happen. But they're extremely rare. In fact, not only is entangled, but this is much stronger, it's maximally entangled, which is quite something. So, okay, so this result is plus a few lines of algebra that you find in the notes proves that other statement that I didn't prove. Remember, I had the square root of ds over db? So it has to do with this formula. Okay? So you can fill in the gaps. Okay, we are done. We have seen a lot of stuff in this course. Okay? We have seen how, for a large system, so many different properties can emerge. So there is no equilibration in quantum mechanics, but it can emerge. There is no order, but it can emerge. There are no gauge theories, maybe, but they can emerge. Entanglement, you could have a state that is entangled or not when you have a few states, but in the large system case, you have emergence of the typicality of entanglement. So we have seen how these kind of topics can tell us about many things, about the foundations of quantum mechanics, what it means to make a measurement, what I should expect on, or in condensed matter theory, what type of orders are possible. And then we discover that these type of orders may feature emergent gauge theories. So this means that high energy theory can be seen as an emergent theory, instead of being fundamental, is the emergent theory of a spin system, for instance. And we have seen how equilibration and thermalization, again, are emergent instead of being fundamental, but they're probabilistically very robust and all of that. So these and other topics constitute this very interdisciplinary subject, as you can see, of quantum matter. And in part two of the course, we will see more applications, and they will be more research-oriented, okay? Trying to understand, to go deeper in some topics and go to see, where there are some open problems in which one can work on. Okay, that's it.